I'd like to start by reading from Whispers from Eternity, Masters 198. Perching in the trees of many lives, I sang thy songs. I, the nightingale of heaven, perched on the boughs of many lives, singing thy songs. My clear song reverberates over soul leaves that flutter with thy life. It thrills the night air in the private garden of centuries where many sleep, dreaming sweet fantasies or, again, nightmares of delusion. It wakens some of them with soft touches of thy reverberating cosmic song. I fly everywhere and give concerts to express thy joy in bowers of receptive hearts. Oh, I will come again and again to lure all souls with my song and to teach them thy songs and invite them all to fly like me in thy skies of cosmic freedom. That poem uses the pronoun I, but the speaker there is Master, talking about one more image of how he moved from lifetime to lifetime trying to enlighten those who would listen. And the reason he has to come, I'm going to have to stand back and see if I can make my throat better. I'm sorry about this. Otherwise, we'll just have to be this kind of gravelly-throated jazz singer today. There's nothing I can do about it, as long as I can get the words out. There, I think it's better now. It comes on me. It's sort of some... It sees the microphone. I really don't know. I've joked for years that there's a special group of demons that incarnate just to infect sound systems. I've actually elevated it to it's the curse of the mummy is what we call it, because it's inexplicable no matter how conscientious we are, no matter how much equipment we have, it finds a way. These special demons, and they come out in there. I was remembering in the early days, this has gone on from the beginning, you should know, when Swami Kriyananda was speaking in San Francisco, and it would be in the late 70s, this is when it was, and he had made some kind of a at that time you had two slide projectors and a recorder, and you had what you called a dissolve unit, and you could make the two slide projectors coordinate according to the recording, and you could get this much more interesting image. Now it would look ridiculously childish compared to what you can do with computers. But at the time, we were the cutting edge of technology, and Swamiji had one of these systems, and they were always just a little more complicated than the people in the room were able to cope with. And on this particular occasion, I, of all people, was the one who was supposed to push the button, and that was all I was supposed to have to do was push the button. And he was giving this program, and I pushed the button, and it didn't work. And I did it multiple times, and it didn't work. And I began to get very more and more concerned. And then there was this little sound that came out of my throat, which was, "It's going to be all right. We're going to make it work," like this. And then gradually, Swamiji himself walked over, and he observed that instead of pushing the play button, I had actually pushed the record button. So not only was there nothing playing out, but everything that was passing over the heads was being erased, and my voice was putting into the, you know, the whole narrative. There was the sound of Asha saying, it's all right," like this. So the next day we were living, we had the San Francisco ashram because we were upstairs in the ashram there, and Swami had to re-record over everything that I had wiped off of the narrative. And not only did he have to re-record, but we all had to keep listening to me saying, it's all right, until Swami said, finally, I sounded like a tour guide in the middle of the jungle surrounded by cannibals who were already boiling the water and I was desperately trying to tell me when it was going to be okay. We were laughing so hysterically. It just was the funniest and the stupidest thing in the world. But I also remember just Swami just looking at me that night of the performance, just very calmly saying, "You push the record button instead of the play button." Nothing else, just an observation of what had happened. And he never reprimanded me or said anything else. I had just pushed the record button. They were real close together, what can I say? And in the moment, it seemed like a good idea. That's about all I can say. Someone was suggesting that Ananda ought to start a whole like weekly cartoon series, which is called "It Seemed Like a Good Idea at the Time." We could just put image after image of whatever it is that did, because we never do it unless it does. I mean, we're dumb, but we're not that dumb. We just don't go out to try to make more trouble for ourselves. Even if we go out to make more trouble for ourselves, it always seemed like a good idea at the time. And this is the great mystery of life. This is the mystery that the Bhagavad Gita addresses continuously. And in the verses that we're talking about, for some reason, I must really have something to learn, because everywhere I turn, I'm in the same like three or four verses in the Bhagavad Gita. I actually believe this is the fourth time in about 3 weeks when I've had to just talk about exactly the same thing. And the short version of what I'm talking about is it seemed like a good idea at the time. And then all these reasons why we can't seem to know that. It's once you know something, it's just so obvious to you what the purpose of it is, what the meaning of it is. But before you know it, you don't know it. It's just like that. I'm very fortunate in my life to have a number of friends who are very different than I, but love me anyway. And I've been able to sort of live through this this look on their face, like Swami's look on his face, "Asha, that was the record button." You know, just like, here's an observation, and with it is just lifetimes of how many times have you pushed the record button when we were trying to push the play button, but, well, here we are again. I remember a time many years ago, and this would have been again in the early 70s, there was a man who had a Church of Religious Science. I think they now call it, they have a different name, but it was called Church of Religious Science at that time. And it was it was something a little bit between traditional churches and what Ananda was doing. Church of Religious Science and Unity fit nicely, and their master was very supportive of both those threads, because they were true, they were expansive. There's actually the first part of this story, I'll go back. This is in Swami Kriyananda's We Have Known Him. And this was, Swamiji himself was, it was before Ananda started. It was after he was expelled from SRF, but before Ananda started. And he was just casting about trying to figure out who he was supposed to be, where he was, what he was supposed to do. Swami's tremendous dilemma during those years was very simple, which was he had been commissioned by his guru to spread his teachings, to serve his work. And Swamiji knew in his heart that he was born for that purpose, but his own gurubais had taken a stand against him, expelled him from the ashram or in the organization, and declared that he was entirely mistaken in his perception of the guru's will. So Swamiji wanted to move extremely carefully, because he had looked to his gurubais to tell him, to help him know what was true, and now he was standing entirely alone. The only guidance he had was inward from his guru, and there was no one in the world to whom he could appeal for confirmation. It had to be entirely within him. One of the reasons that for many years of Ananda, like many years, Swamiji took such an understated role as a leader was because he wanted to be absolutely certain that if in any way he developed a following of people who were looking to him for spiritual inspiration, looking to him to be a channel for us from Master, Swamiji wanted to be certain it was imposed upon him, not sought by him personally. Now, our topic today is ego, and how can you tell, and is it a friend, and all of that. Well, Swami Kriyananda, who had more right than anyone that I've ever known, of course, to stand firm in his inward guidance, was one of the most careful and the most humble about it. So I think there's a lesson there that we need to pay attention to. But going through this, during this period of time, Swamiji had gone to the desert, I believe in Arizona, somewhere in that area, to take a period of seclusion, and had stopped on the way back to stay in this particular motel that was people that he knew indirectly, friends of friends who ran a small business, and they ran it for the benefit of the indigenous people there. So it was a good cause. You could stay in this inn, and then you could also help people. As it happened, I was speaking about the Church of Religious Science minister, was very much engaged in a fundamentalist lifestyle and was on his way from California to Texas to enroll in a Bible college to become a fundamentalist minister, a Pentecostal minister of some kind. He'd been traveling with his wife and his mother-in-law, and they were absolutely fighting the entire time, the entire trip. It was just a nightmare experience. They all converge in this dining room. This man ends up sitting at Swami's table, because it's sort of an inn more than a restaurant, and they're chatting, and he hears Swamiji talking about spiritual things. And the way the man writes tells the story, which is written in the book, he said everybody else just acted as if what was going on was normal. But for this man, he said Swami's words and his voice sounded like thunder in his ears. And everything he said just reverberated with the voice of God. And he'd never met him before. He didn't know anything about him. But as he put it, he could feel that this man was the real deal. And from that moment, he said his wife and his mother-in-law and he, they stopped fighting. The rest of the trip was harmonious. But he also knew that he was not going to be a Pentecostal minister. And he directed his life, and he didn't become a disciple of Master, but he found another way to express himself. And then he had this church in Reno, Nevada, this Church of Religious Science, which he ran for many years. And from time to time, whenever Swami was willing, he would invite Swamiji to come and speak. So this was one of the occasions, and a little crowd of us who would follow Swamiji around went up there for that event. For some reason, I seem to remember that we used to have to walk through the casino to get to where the church was, but that seems a little strange. But there was something like that. Maybe it was a different trip. This was a long time ago. But Reno is Reno, so there you have it. But there's a very metaphysical, a lot of people who live out in the desert have a very metaphysical attitude. And also, it has to be said, a lot of people who see the world differently don't live in the, you know, they don't live in New York City on Wall Street. They're not in the heart of what America is doing, making money and all of this. They tend to find a more peripheral place. And a lot of Nevada has a lot of that. Much of it is quite interesting. So there's a very solid group in that church, of very serious metaphysicians is what I would call them. So Swami gave this beautiful talk. It was just wonderful, as I recall. And he was lifted up, as he often was, and sometimes it would show more. He was just lifted into another state of consciousness. I observed him and was with him enough that I wasn't absolutely by any means sensitive to his moods, but I could sometimes feel, you know, when he was shifting, and he was definitely shifted. And then he stood, as a clergy person would at the end of the service, to greet everybody who was in the service. It would have been 50 people, not more. And I stood, as I always would, in some unobtrusive place, but close where I could just watch Swami. And I just watched him. And these people, who had been very moved by his service, sort of came up, and I'm moving my hands like this, because it was sort of like they were in a line, and they would come up, and they would stand in front of him and greet him, and then they would move aside, and the next person would come. Because I was picking up whatever Swami was picking up, I felt all of a sudden just like the walls of the building went down and the parameters of life went away. I was reading there about that little nightingale. Life after life, I've sat in the branches and sung your divine song, trying to wake people from their sweet dreams or their nightmares. Whichever one, Master just runs it as the same. I'm trying to awaken you from your sweet dreams or your nightmares, whatever they might be, of this limited world that you imagine to be the real world, and to invite you to soar in the cosmic skies of freedom where I live. This is Master's little verse that I just read at the beginning here. Well, Swami was standing there, and there we were someplace that we'd been a lot of times before. And because I was riding his coattails, I was riding with him. There was no vision. I didn't see any pyramids. I didn't see any lost island of Atlantis or nothing like that. But we were not where we usually were. And all of these people who are coming in front of Swamiji, this is my feeling about it, but I will verify it by saying that this book, Swami Kriyananda, as we have known him, Swami read every word of that book. We sat side by side before it was published. It was a manuscript. He read every word of it. And he corrected anything he felt needed to be corrected. So he did not correct this, what I'm saying to you. And I felt that all of these people were connected to Swamiji, but not as I was, in the sense that, for me, Swami was the pole star. Wherever he went, that was my route. But these were souls that, especially through their minister, Swami's friend now, they all had, through him, they had some connection. And it was like each one would come and stand in front of Swamiji, and he would give them as much as they were able to hold of expanded perception, of awakening call to God, of a realization about the true and the lasting purpose of life. And Swami wasn't talking a lot, but they would exchange pleasantries, as it were, just greet each other. But the words were not there. It was this vibrational flow. And it was almost visible. That's the only word I can use. It was almost visible that the stream would run, the cup would fill. When the cup was full, then it would move aside and the next cup would come forward. I mean, these were people, I'm not denigrating them, but it was so impersonal. And it was just happening because it was God's will that it happened. In living with Swamiji for as long as I did, as being associated with him, I began to understand this extraordinarily interesting reality between being yourself and not being yourself at all. It's still words to me, but I'm beginning to understand it more, is the way I would say it. And what happens as we advance spiritually is that there's no impediments. I mean, we always are, where does the life force come from? It's like, I don't know where it comes from. I don't go to I ordered something over Amazon recently. I needed a big plastic bucket. I ordered a big plastic bucket, and in a couple of days, a big plastic bucket is going to arrive at my door. I could go through the internet. We all do it, you know, especially nowadays. Everything's ordering online, and you want something, you find it, and then it shows up on your doorstep, and by the time it comes, you've forgotten because you've ordered six or seven other things, and it's always Christmas, you're always opening new boxes to see what it is that you got. And, you know, it's just, there it is. But this life force itself, the impulse to want a plastic bucket, the intelligence that knows where to find it, the hands that are going to open the box and then are going to remember what it's for and then put it to use. We do all of that all the time. I wake up in the morning thinking about, you know, what am I supposed to do today and how can I orient myself immediately in proper relationship to God? All of these things, where does that come from? But it is the given. And by the grace of God, through the practice of yoga and meditation and kriya and prayer and energization and whispers from eternity, I'm learning how to mold this energy in a direction that is a better idea than some of the ideas I've had in the past. But the force itself, I don't own it. And when I die, it'll just exit from this body. I mean, when we come in as babies, Master says that the baby cries because it realizes, here I am again. Here we go again. My favorite picture of myself, which I kept on the wall for a while, I've long since taken it down. I'm about 9 months, and I'm at the stage where you can kind of pull yourself up, but you can't really get any higher than this. But I'm pulled up, and you know, the baby's eyes are big because their heads are little, and their eyes are big. And I can look at her, which is me, and see she was ready to go. You know, she's just ready to crawl, she's ready to walk, and she's certainly looking to talk. You can see it just right there, just trying to do it. But where does it come from? And that's what it is that we gradually learn, that I'm the vehicle for all of this, but this is something completely other than me. This is my assignment. You know, to use this little stream of energy, it's just given to me. It's my assignment, and I'm supposed to use it however it seems to want to go. And the process of spiritual life is just being more and more appropriately attuned to where it's trying to go. And what I saw in Swamiji, as complete contrast to myself, is that he accepted with confidence and courage where it was trying to go. And I am always second-guessing where it's trying to go, or putting on it some, but what if, and oh, I can't, and that frightens me, and what will we do here, and I want, which is I want yes, and I want no, but it's the same, I want. Whereas Swamiji just arrives. He just arrives and then waits to see what it's going to do. I mean, that's called not having vrittis in your chakras. That's a very high level of realization. But it is the destiny of all of us. I was told recently about a statement from Ramana Maharshi, who was a very great saint who lived, I think he lived till about 1960, I'm not sure. Master met him when Master went to India in 1935. He's a very, very advanced soul. And he talked about trying to explain what it feels like to be him. And he just talked about this force field that just moves through him. And he is the force field, but there's no personal self saying yes or no to the force field. There's absolute faith in this running through. I remember when I was involved with Swamiji and we were doing a little political action. The county, the planning director for the county was not competent for the job she had, and Ananda was the breaking point for her, because you needed to be a high-level planning professional to know what to do with our mixed land use. I mean, these are all the terms. It was actually very straightforward. But at that point, Nevada County was just a little backwater, and she'd literally been promoted from being a secretary. She was a competent secretary and ended up leading the department because all she ever had to do was just issue building permits, and then all of a sudden there was us. And Swami was astute enough to realize that she absolutely had no idea how to deal with us, and the only way she knew to deal with us was to get rid of us. And she was going to stonewall our development forever until we went away. Others thought we might be able to win her by being nice. Swami knew that wasn't true. So he started this political action, which, as it happened, it went over from 1975 to 1976, which was the 200th anniversary of America. So he created something he called the Bicentennial Liberty Committee, which, as he wrote later, he said, he got me involved by characterizing the thing as a madcap adventure. That's how he put it. He said he appealed to my sense of humor. And then we did this, and we had to get this woman fired. She'd already been condemned by the grand jury. We were on solid ground, but no one, we'd never done anything like this. Ananda had never touched this, and almost no one in the community saw it the way Swami saw it. And we were just kids, and we didn't know, but he'd run countries for many lifetimes, and he knew what was going on here. So we did this whole political action thing, which I've written up in both Light Bearer and in Swami Kriyananda's. You have known him, so I advise you, I suggest that you read it. It's highly entertaining, and it was very instructive. And he unrolled this strategic plan that worked exactly the way he wanted it to work, and eventually she got fired, and a competent professional came in, and Ananda's still there and has managed to develop. But when the whole thing finished, and I was really just his obedient minion. I had no idea what we were doing. He would say, write a letter to the local newspaper about the building inspector's, prejudice in favor of certain things against other things. I say, how nasty, Swamiji. He would say, medium nasty. And then I'd write a medium nasty letter. And then he would say, write one about the county attorney, how nasty. He said, top nasty. Okay, very nasty. And I would just, and it created this whole incredible kerfuffle, which resulted in her getting fired. There was more to it, but I don't have time to say it. But when it all finished, first of all, Swami called it, and this was like, I didn't know then that he'd been King Henry the I and Alfonso the X and, just all these things. I thought it was really like this incredible thing we did. He looked at me, he said, a tempest in a teapot is what he said. I mean, it meant nothing to him by comparison. But I said, did you know how this was going to come out? Because just one thing played into another perfectly. He said, no, not at all. But I'm not surprised. And that was really interesting to me because it clued me into something that I watched and I had confirmed many times after. Swami didn't know. You would see him do something that worked out in a beautiful manner, and I would think that he'd calculated it. But he never calculated. He trusted. If the impulse was coming through him, he simply knew what it felt like and he would just go with it. I mean, that's what it is that we're working with. We're not working with a real smart ego, a real organized ego, an ego has all the rules, an ego who knows exactly what my boss wants and is going to do it, who has all the rules of the spiritual path. We're dealing with a complete transfer of our identification from the limited to the unlimited. I mean, a surfer gets on his board and he knows what he has to do, but it's the wave that he's riding. The surfer, you can put that surfboard on the beach and he can stand up there with all the technique in the world and zero is going to happen. He has to go out into the ocean, he has to find the wave, and then he rides it. And he doesn't even know where it's going, he has to just figure it out and try to do it exactly right. He has to be absolutely attentive and committed. But what he's committed to is riding the wave. Now, that's the whole path of yoga. That is our destiny. And that's what we see in front of us. If Swami writes in the path that Master was so charming and so lovable and such a friend, just everything about him was so wonderful. He said, many people failed to appreciate the magnitude of the revolution to which he was calling us. And that's us. We have been called. That little bird lures us out of our sweet dreams or our nightmares. And we go off to fly in cosmic freedom. Perhaps not today, perhaps not tomorrow. But if we give ourselves to it as God invites us to do, then eventually, and then soon, it will be now. God bless you.
In India there lived by the banks of a stream a hermit whose prayers chose applause for their theme. He gazed at the flowers and he smiled at the sun. Then he clapped with delight, Lord, he cried, oh, well done. Well done, Lord, oh, very well done. The mountains that laugh with the gypsy clouds, the fields smile to welcome the sun. All nature sings praises aloud. The fields smile to welcome the sun. the sun. All nature sings praises aloud. The trees dance to show their elation. A day on God's earth has begun. And every true heart in creation in speechless wonder is bound. This wonder is bowed. Well done, Lord, oh very well done. The joy that you've planted in children's hearts, the thrill known in bearing a son, the hope when a trial departs. The thrill known in bearing a son, the hope when a trial departs. The gladness of men in their victories won. Joys are the proof of your labors. How wonderful, Lord, are your arms. Our joys are the proof of your labors. How wonderful, Lord, are your arms. Well done, Lord, oh very well done. At last I've discovered the mystic key, the world's joy, oh secretive one, replies your sweetness in me. The world's joy, oh secretive one, replies your sweetness in me. For here in my heart lies the answer, your love shedding light.